Hello, and welcome to Fathoming Water. I'm your host, Melissa Mosey. In our last episode, we talked with doctoral candidate Zach Sugg of the University of Arizona. Zach and I talked about how groundwater is managed and treated as private property in the state of Texas. We explored the disconnect between surface water and groundwater management for both Texas and Arizona, and had a special focus on the Edwards Aquifer located near San Antonio. In this week's episode, we focus on Pima County, and we get another chance to understand how the bifurcation of surface water and groundwater management policy affects how natural resources are managed. This week, we talk with Julia Fonseca, who has worked on land and water issues in southern Arizona since 1986. Currently, Julia is the Environmental Planning Manager for the Office of Sustainability and Conservation at Pima County, where she works with other individuals, agencies, and groups towards protecting natural resources. She co-authored a widely cited report for the EPA regarding the ecological and hydrologic significance of ephemeral and intermittent streams in the southwestern U.S. She was also instrumental in the creation of the Sonoran Desert Conservation Plan, which we discuss in this episode, including the fact the multi-species Section 10 permit that benefits further development while protecting natural resources is only now about ready to be added to the Federal Register by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She is currently working on the Living River program that is restoring wetlands in the Santa Cruz River using reclaimed water from the Pima County sewage treatment plants. Pima County, in partnership with the Sonoran Institute, has excellent information on this exceptional program if you want to learn more. Early on in her career, she was tasked with protecting some of the rarest and most ecologically important surface water in Pima County, and she identifies that the bifurcation of surface water and groundwater policy undermines any agency's ability to fully fulfill that task. She has to think about processes across the system that involve ecology, planning, law, and community needs. What I am discovering in these Fathoming Water interviews are that the best resource planners are able to see the big picture and break it down into all of its interrelated parts. Julia's background is in hydrology and geology, like many of our previous guests. Julia Fonseca and Marie Perthrey from the Central Arizona Project, who we talked with in Episode 9, both began their careers at the University of Arizona in the 1980s, and both studied the flooding that happened in Pima County after the El Niño-produced flooding that had major impacts on transportation in Tucson. Julia identifies that it was a perfect time to get in to flood management as well as to start looking at natural resource management in the context of climate change. It was, in fact, Marie Perthrey leaving a position at Pima County that began Julia's career with Pima County. I bring this up because one of the points that Julia brings up is the human connections between people underlie the positive and thoughtful decisions that surround water, and it is often these connections that land people on the perfect career path for providing water for people and the environment. And now, Julia Fonseca. Today I'm sitting here with Julia Fonseca. How about you give us an overview? You have a long career with Pima County. Why don't you give us a background on that?
Okay, well, I came here as a graduate student at the University of Arizona to study geomorphology, and I wanted to know more specifically about how the Earth is shaped by flooding in particular, and it was 1983, and it was the year of the giant 1983 October floods that we had, so that proved to be a really great time to start looking at how people utilize floodplains and how society responds to big events like that. It was also a time when people started to think about the impact of El Niños on the flooding processes, so it was a really rich time to be entering into the hydrologic communities. I started out with the Pima County Regional Flood Control District, and I was hired as a temporary hydrologist, and that was in 1986. It was right in the aftermath of the floods, and we were starting to do all sorts of projects along the rivers. So that was a great opportunity to learn more about Pima County. Coming out of the university, I have to say, I didn't know much about Pima County at all, except for my studies of the flood. Then one of the things that I was assigned that first year was stewardship of a tract of land that was so so significant. It's called the Cienega Creek Natural Preserve now, and it was the first time that the flood control district was given responsibility to take care of a piece of land. And I think it was a very instrumental step in the evolution of that organization. Because when you take responsibility for land, you know, that's a long-term commitment, and it's something that makes you think about the tracks you leave in history, basically. Already the Flood Control District was moving towards a sense of responsibility for natural recharge processes, because the science that was coming out at the time was telling us that rivers are really important places for natural recharge processes to operate, and that when we constrain the flows of the rivers down to this little corridor, we're actually impacting that natural recharge process, which puts water back into our aquifers. So the Flood Control District was already, especially in the aftermath of the flood, kind of moving away from a typical gray infrastructure-only approach to start to embrace green infrastructure, a term that wasn't even in existence at the time. This was in the late 80s,
oh, wow.
And it was because of some of the science that was going on at the University of Arizona. So we started modifying the approach to move the soil cement embankments back from the river to allow more meandering and natural processes to occur within that reach. And you can kind of see that reflected, like if you go downtown, you see Rio Nuevo Reach, the first bank protection that was built in the city of Tucson. That's very much a very narrow straight channel. And as some of the older projects are like that, very constraining. But with time, a lot of the newer projects actually moved those embankments way far back. And even then when the levee was built in Marana, that's called a setback levee. It's built way away from the channel so that there can be natural floodplain processes and also take advantage of this ridge that kind of keeps the whole system going. There is a project called Cortero Mesquite Bosque, which is a flood control project that's located along the Santa Cruz River. It's on a terrace of the river, and there's a tributary that comes in there, and the water from that tributary is harvested into basins, and that's part of what supports the bosque. There's also some water from the Santa Cruz River. The Marana Irrigation District is the supplier for some additional supplemental water at that site.
If we were to pass future bonds mm-hmm. for flood control in the future, what sorts of projects could we accomplish or with that bond money?
The proposed 2016 bonds included some monies that would be allocated for the Tres Rios del Norte project area, which is at the confluence of the Rito and the Cañada del Oro, where it comes into the Santa Cruz River. So that's the Three Rivers area. And El Corazon there, they call it the El Corazon, the heart of the Three Rivers, it's an archaeologically rich area. Mm-hmm. It's also an area of great destruction in terms of the past sand and gravel pits and all that. So one of the questions is, how do we think about the future in that area? These gravel pits are pretty much done. They are in need of, that landscape is in need of reclamation. Could these areas be used for sort of macro water harvesting from the Cañada del Oro and Rito rivers? Could it support public recreation, economic development, riparian restoration? That is one of the kind of big focal areas for the future. Another is, how do we deal with the repair needs that exist in the Continental Ranch area, where the bank stabilization that was built by the developer there, that was Charles Keating back in the 80s, the toe down or the depth to which the bank protection goes, it's not adequate for current conditions. And it's needing a lot of repair. So what happens with that is another thing. Where are we going to get the money to fix that area up and keep the existing development safe?
That's a great point to bring up. Infrastructure and the degradation of mm-hmm. infrastructure over time and needing money to just mm-hmm. to maintain infrastructure is such a huge issue in our country in general.
Yes.
And to think about that in terms of flood control and specific projects.
And then a lot of people don't realize that the municipal sewers usually run next to the bank protection. In many cases, the bank protection was put in after the sewer. The rivers are the lowest part of the landscape, so that's why the sewers were generally put down along the rivers. And what wasn't realized at the time some of those decisions were made is how mobile the channel banks are naturally. And so the bank protection has usually been put in there to protect this investment in the sewer system, which is the foundation of our civilization, practically. If you don't have good sanitary sewer systems and treatment, you really don't have a good basis for a city anyway. So when you talk about flood control, you're talking not only about public health, but you're also talking about transportation. The lesson of the 1983 flood was that, you know, we don't have a good, robust transportation system if our bridges are all blown out.
Yeah.
So a lot of what happened after the 83 flood was we had the 86 bond election, which repaired a lot of the bridges, and that was very costly.
Yeah.
But it's a very long-term investment to get better bridges. You know, you have to drill deeper to put those piers down so that they aren't eroded. That's more costly than if you build little shallow piers.
But the wider the river and the more flow, the less likely that's going to happen.
Right.
You're solving so many problems, really working on just the nuts and bolts of how the community interacts with the environment.
The things that I got involved in the 80s, the stewardship of the Cienega Creek Preserve, the responsibility that I was given was to say, take care of this place, do what you can to protect it. And as a hydrologist, that was a really interesting challenge because, I mean, nothing in my schooling had prepared me really for how do I take care of a piece of land.
Interesting. So that's how you move into planning.
So that's how I moved into planning and environmental stuff. I mean, planning was already really embedded into the work of the flood control district because a lot of what was happening then, you know, these master plan communities were being built. You had to think into the future how to allow this development but also not impair these flood processes and keep people out of harm's way. So a lot of the kind of work that we were drawn into was work that had to do with planning the policies for these new communities. So that was already there, but the land stewardship responsibilities of this area, it was one of the few flowing streams left in the Pima County. I mean, other than the Santa Cruz River, which no longer flowed because of groundwater pumping, there's Sabino Creek, and there was Cienega Creek. And there was a rancher there who really wanted us to take care of this land. I mean, he required that the district, as part of the acquisition of the land, take over an in-stream flow water right. And that was one of the protective measures that he had actually started. So my responsibility was to continue the effort to get the in-stream flow water protection for this property. In the fullness of time, that hasn't really helped to protect it. The surface water laws of the state of Arizona don't prevent other people from coming in and utilizing groundwater resources, and they're treated as two separate
legal entities.
The bifurcation of water law, has really not protected surface water rights holders.
And so was this property sold, or was this a conservation easement from that rancher?
It was sold with all the property rights.
But very, very forward-looking and very progressive at the time.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, his name is Walter Armour. And he was actually a former president of the Arizona Cattle Growers Association.
Oh.
And so this is, it turns out that this area is the most species-rich part of Pima County and includes now some endangered species that have actually moved into the area since we've acquired it, in part because of the stewardship that we've been able to provide, which has included removing some of the livestock from the riparian area.
So how is that transition for you? Because we have a lot of students listening. In terms of moving from a very science background to now you're working with many different groups to develop things like the Sonoran Conservation Plan, mm-hmm. working at the top levels of planning for the county. How did you gain information along the way? Did you have to educate yourself further?
Oh, completely. Tucson is a special place, in part because there is what I feel rather porous walls between people who are in academia, people who are in community organizations, and people who are in government. And that interchange makes this a very rich place to live, I think. And there have been plenty of mentors for me and others in the community. And to draw from that, during the Sonoran Desert Conservation Plan, this required the county to understand more about the natural resources, including species, that exist here in Pima County. And we drew from 150 different collaborating and contributing scientists, most of whom are in Pima County, but some at ASU and other places as well.
So one of the reasons that I had you in today is because you participated in the Sustainable Water for Southern Arizona Community Forum, which is, as you were saying, it's very porous. It was bringing together members mm-hmm. of the community, members of water planners, environmental people. What's the greatest impact for involving the community in water decisions, bringing them into the conversation?
So a lot of times I feel like people don't understand how the existing system works. If you want to tinker with the system, you got to understand how things are related. And so the biggest need, I think, is for people who have different perspectives to help everybody understand how the system works. That you tinker with one part of it, you're affecting some other part of it that you might not have thought about and that is valued by some aspect of the community. So that's one of the benefits, I think, of these collaborations and these communications across the silos of government and academia and nonprofits and business and ranching community. You know, each has something to contribute to the conversation. When people aren't at the table, then decisions sometimes are made that will hurt that community that's left out.
Now, Pima County seems to be one of the organizations, one of the institutions that definitely draws a lot of people together. And it seems to be that our wastewater treatment being part of the county and flood control being part of the county, while the city has control of the water, is part of that shaping that. Is that true, or is that situation unique for Tucson to have the county managing the wastewater and the city managing the water?
I think it is unique in the state. Usually the people who are controlling the water also control the effluent, and that's sort of the way that Arizona law recognizes. The treater is generally the owner of the effluent and gets to dispose of the effluent in whatever way they see fit. But in 1979, the city and the county reached an agreement that gave responsibility for the treatment of sewage to the county in exchange for giving most of the 90% of the effluent to the city. So that was a contract, basically, that changed how things operate here in Tucson. And I believe it is fairly unique.
You've worked for the county for your entire career?
Pretty much.
So there must be a great benefit to being at the county level. What's the benefit to working at the county level?
One of the things I like about working at the county, at local government, I guess, is I guess it calls for a broad range of skills. It calls for being part of your community. And it's been an incredible learning opportunity for me. I have really enjoyed understanding how a system works. I mean, that's what I do. I think about, you know, how does this system work, which includes all the people and all the species and all the, you know, the land surface processes that operate above ground anyway, and some of them that operate below ground even in the case of aquifer recharge. So the interaction is what I enjoy, both with people and with cutting-edge research that's going on at the university that tells me more about the place that I live. So I feel like that's a pretty interesting place to be. The other thing is about working, I guess, at the county, it's not like working at a utility where you have only one perspective. You know, you only provide one service to customers in a utility perspective. I mean, we're local government, so we're called upon to think about a huge range of issues that citizens find important. So that's a challenge, but it's also a lot more interesting.
This most recent project you're working on, the Santa Cruz River, you were talking about effluent, has been recharged with effluent. It makes it all the way to Marana, doesn't it?
Well, that's changing. So the community, really through sewer rates, has invested a lot of money in improving the quality of the effluent. And that has cleaned up the effluent so much that we're seeing a lot of new aquatic life in the river that is supported by effluent discharges. So there are wetlands along the Santa Cruz River, and it used to be that the river of effluent would flow from the discharge point all the way out of Pima County into Pinal County. But the river was of such poor quality that very little could live in it. Now there are fish. Now that we're seeing frogs and we are seeing turtles, and the changes are happening quickly, and the Living River Project is part of what is monitoring those changes. So we are seeing the extent of flow is much reduced, and that's related to the higher infiltration rates. This effluent is so much cleaner. It has so few nutrients now that the algae that had clogged the sediment is no longer clogging it anymore. The infiltration rates have greatly increased, which means we're getting more aquifer recharge. At the same time, there have been some pretty big changes in the distribution of effluent. So some of the effluent that came out at the Roger Road treatment plant near the Sweetwater Wetlands, that is greatly reduced because now the infiltration in the off-channel recharge basins that Tucson Water has constructed are so high. So they're able to put way more water into aquifer recharge via those basins, and there's a lot less water being discharged to the river. So that water isn't even making it to Ina Road. And then at Ina Road, there's an additional effluent discharge, and that is no longer flowing all the way to Marana. So we have a recharge project that takes water from the Santa Cruz River into an abandoned sort of meander of the river. And it supports a nice riparian area, and then it goes into our effluent recharge basins there. And that isn't getting as much water as it used to because so much of it's infiltrating further upstream.
Wow, that brings together what you were talking about, every little piece matters, and the whole network, and if you miss one thing. Because I had heard that before, that the effluent, the algae would coat the bottom of the stream and you weren't getting the recharge. But that's fantastic that we're getting the recharge into the Tucson Basin, not just Avra Valley.
Right.
Oh, that's great. And you started out your career, you were doing a lot of field work, you were doing a lot of research. Do you still get to go out in the field and do these monitoring programs? Or are you the one that's managing your group of biologists? Are you working mostly with negotiating with other people?
So I'm the one mostly in the office. We do have two really capable biologists now who are out in the field quite a bit looking at species and also at water. Every June, they go out and look at the extent of waters that are out there on the landscape for wildlife. And so that's an important thing to note. And it's really, you know, a tiny amount of water out there. We've seen a lot of contractions of flow. We are seeing reduced flows on springs. Now, we'll see this year in June whether the more normal winter rains have made any difference. But we've had so many years of drought that we have seen a lot of reductions in the areas of waters available for wildlife.
Let's talk about the Sonoran Conservation Desert Plan. Pima County, along with many, many others, were involved in the Sonoran Conservation Desert Plan. So if you wouldn't mind going into the history of how that developed, and it was a true negotiating masterpiece to get it done. It's a fantastic thing that happened for the area. So if you wouldn't mind reviewing the history of that.
Sure. So the Sonoran Desert Conservation Plan came out of the kind of land use conflicts of the 90s. There were bitter, bitter battles between developers and neighborhood activists and community groups about land use. And into that scenario in the late 90s flew the Cactus ferruginous pygmy owl, a species that was listed as endangered with critical habitat in, I think it was 1997. This species occupied a lot of the area that was growing the most rapidly, where a lot of the new development was occurring. And it threw into question whether or not the kinds of land uses that the county and town of Marana and even Oro Valley had allocated to that landscape. The typical thing that happens in such endangered species conflicts is that developers ask for something called a Section 10 permit. This is a permit that allows for development under a regional conservation plan, allows development to go forward in exchange for conservation measures that benefit multiple types of species, including, in this case, the pygmy owl. But the community decided that this conversation was not just going to be about the pygmy owl, and it was not just going to be about endangered species. It was going to be about how we use land, how we use money and growth policies to allocate densities across the landscape, how we treasure or what we treasure in terms of our cultural heritage, and not just about endangered wildlife, but really all types of wildlife and plants indigenous to Pima County. So it was a very wide-ranging set of topics, and fortunately there were a lot of great people in the community and in local governments and in the development sector who came together to have that conversation. There was a self-selected steering committee that started out with like 150 people, 3 years later, when they had formalized their recommendations, there were still 88 people at the table who came from all walks of life. And they indeed recommended that we go forward with this Section 10 permit, but they kind of set a framework for us to operate under. In the meantime, the community developed a set of agreements about what was acceptable. And that formed the foundation for the successful 2004 open space bond. It also paved the way, if you will, for the a half-cent sales tax that had been stymied by previous efforts. I mean, the community had never been able to come together on a half-cent sales tax to fund transportation, in part because of these differing ideas about how land use should be allocated. So the thing that the conservation plan resolved that was kind of around the framework of land use was that, yes, we should grow where our infrastructure is, but not really support sprawl across the entire landscape. That was something that actually was fiscally irresponsible. And there were a lot of studies to show where do we get our tax base. It comes with intense development. It comes where there is a sewer system that can support high-density development. And so it kind of resolves some of the tensions that had existed between the development community and the environmentalists, but also some of the conflicts that had existed with the ranchers. One of the most revolutionary ideas that came out of it was the idea that through partnerships with the ranching community, we could actually get things done that everybody wanted to see, which is protection of cultural heritage, protection of species. I mean, the ranches were really where a lot of the species were. And the ranch, it's the breakup of the family ranches. When those are sold to development, that's how we get a lot of this far-flung satellite communities and sprawl across the landscape that turns out to be fairly costly to the tax base over the long term.
Because of having to build more roads, building more sewers, building more pipes.
Right. Or even, I mean, a lot of these satellite communities don't even have roads and sewers. I mean, when you take a ranch and you split it up into a bunch of little pieces, each person developing their own part, you know, a lot of times you can't really support high density. There is no infrastructure. And these are some of the legacies that we have from previous decades of development. We have areas that really just, you know, they don't have libraries, they don't have good roads, you know. So that kind of happened under a pre-existing concept as these ranches got sold off.
There must have been a political push to push through the sales tax. How does that work?
Well, in the case of the sales tax, one of the items that was necessary to get to yes, if you will, was to say that the regional transportation plan should put infrastructure in the places that we agreed under the Sonoran Desert Conservation Plan that land use should go, which is the areas outside what we call the conservation land system, the places where a lot of the infrastructure, especially the sewer infrastructure, already exists. The other part of that was to allocate $45 million for wildlife connectivity. So today you see constructed or under the process of completion that wildlife crossing on Oracle Road. That was part of that negotiation, if you will. The community said, we want to have money available to repair some of the damage that's been done in the past to wildlife movements. And some of these culverts and overpasses are part of that.
So you see land set aside that is not to be developed. Mm-hmm. And that is in the Pygmy Owl area primarily?
Some of it is. The two areas where the Pygmy Owl had occupied were in the Tortolitas and then in the Altar Valley. And so the 2004 bond election included the promise to the voters that we would acquire lands in both those areas. So, yes, it includes not only lands for Pygmy Owl habitat, but for a wide range of species. So these are among the lands that we are providing stewardship today and that will form the basis for the Section 10 permit that we started to get. Now, we haven't even gotten the Section 10 permit. We've done all this work in terms of reforming, you know, our regulations to avoid the impacts to species, and we bought the mitigation lands, but we haven't gotten the permit, and the reason is just slowness in the federal government. Nobody forces a community to get a Section 10 permit. These are voluntary things, and so they kind of are at the bottom of the stack of things that Fish and Wildlife Service has to do. So they're very close to issuing that permit. We expect perhaps even next month that we will see in the Federal Register their announcement to issue the Section 10 permit to Pima County. And this will provide a new way for developers to comply with the Endangered Species Act, and it will use the lands that the community has already agreed to acquire under the Sonoran Desert Conservation Plan as mitigation. So we've acquired those lands, we're managing those lands, we're prepared to monitor them. We will commit them to conservation long-term as a consequence of the permit. So we've been doing the mitigation. We haven't been getting the credit
So this gives you the credit.
So this will basically provide the framework to give us the credit. It does allow, we have something called the permit area.
Okay.
And that's most of unincorporated Pima County. So it does allow development in unincorporated Pima County. And for those private property developers who want to come in under our permit, then the county will provide the mitigation out of the amount of lands that we've acquired previously.
Okay, that's fascinating. Yeah. Okay, that's really interesting. I didn't know that's how that worked. And that's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
That's
that,
right.
That
yeah.
does that. Okay. So really using very creative policy techniques to be able to protect land, that's such a key aspect of your job.
Yes.
How are you always looking outside the box for these kinds of solutions? Or is it networking with other people that you start to realize, oh, we could do this and this on this partnership level? Or
yeah, networking certainly helps. I mean, there are sometimes things that we hear about from outside the community that help us do our jobs better. But I would say that a lot of it comes from just working with a great set of people. I mean, there's people. I mean, one of the things I like about my job at Pima County is the kind of people that I get to work with. They're always looking out for, like, how can we do this better? How can we try something, you know, new? There is some willingness, I think, because of our past successes, to take a risk and try something new. People work together, and we've just got a great set of people.
So information flow seems to be a big aspect in Tucson.
Yes.
That you're identifying, that I guess other people have kind of alluded mm-hmm. to, but that you're really bringing that together, that we have so many nonprofits like TNC, and we've got Watershed Management Group, and we've got the U of A, and then all the county level, mm-hmm. and everyone is really working together.
And the city.
And the city.
Yeah, all these different groups have really, I mean, community-minded folks, I think, is part of what we have here in Tucson. So, you know, hopefully we will not go back to the way things were in the 80s with a lot of divisiveness and lack of trust.
How do you think that grew? How did that community-mindedness grow here in Tucson?
It was a lot of hard work.
Okay.
A lot of informal processes, I think, help. A lot of spending time with each other. Tucson, a lot of people seem to stay in Tucson for long periods of time.
But get to know each other.
But we do get to know each other, yeah. And I think I can't underscore how important informal settings are. The fact that you can meet somebody in a grocery store accidentally, you might know them through some other school, your kid's school or your doctor's office or your whatever in the community. The fact that you're not only representing your agency, but you've got other ties to lots of other people in the community, I think that makes a big difference.
We tend to think about things like the environment and people being so different, but really it's the coming together of people that helps support the improvement of the environment. Now, what about in terms of mm-hmm. environmental improvements, degradation, what sort of changes have you seen?
So, drought, climate change, increased groundwater utilization, increased population. We are definitely seeing reductions in aquatic resources on the landscape. We are seeing, in some cases, during the 2002 through 2006 drought, we were seeing mesquite bosques die and other long-lived plant communities being affected that are in the uplands, more soil loss coming from the hill slopes. So we have a very delicate situation out there right now as a result of so many years of reduced precipitation and higher temperatures. So these are things that we need to understand, and we're going to have to be even more, work together even more across communities and to conserve resources. There are some really great things that people are doing and learning about how to take care of soil and land and vegetation, and realizing, I guess, how past practices contributed to some of that degradation. One of the neat things that, for instance, in the Altar Valley, the ranchers and Pima County and others have been working on understanding how roads affect drainage, and how even grading, simple grading of a dirt road, the way that you grade it affects a big area around it. And you can actually start a lot of erosion problems with poor grading. And so there are ways to minimize the impacts on how water moves across the landscape with your road grading. And so some of it is just like getting the guys who grade the roads up on, you know, teaching them some practices to do their job better.
And is the county responsible for that, or is that one of your...
We have had some of our road maintenance crews trained on these techniques in partnership with some of the ranches who also maintain roads out there on the landscape for hunter access and so forth. And that is having some beneficial effects. It can be simple things. I mean, that's actually not so simple. I mean, it does take a lot of awareness of what you're doing to understand your effects on the broader landscape. You're going to have to learn to get more water into the soil and store it and run it through plant life. I mean, that is another way of being efficient. People tend to think of efficiency. Water efficiency is just let's use less water. Let's build something that uses less water. But that's not the only way to be efficient. Another way is to say, you know, we're going to have less rainfall, but we can be more effective at capturing that rainfall and getting it into the ground where it can do some good, either through evaporation and reducing the ambient temperature of the surrounding landscape, or to supply plant life, which then provides productivity for livestock and wildlife and many other things that we value about our landscape. So,
and it's all because of collaboration and being able to work within...
And learning from each other, yes.
And learning from each other.
And so another thing the county's done is to start its own native plant nursery. Yeah, we have our own native plant nursery, and it's really a neat thing. Actually, Petey Mosquito was the first Pima County native plant nursery operator. So the first native plant nursery was located next to our waste treatment facility, okay, so that we could use the effluent to irrigate some of the plants, right? More recently, we've moved it to the Pima County Natural Resources Parks and Recreation area. They have a campus, if you will. The nursery is now there, and it's not for the public. It is to support our own projects. So Pima County is one of the biggest developers in the area. We build lots of public projects, and we want to make sure that we use as many native plants as possible. The nursery started in 2003, and at that time we were having trouble getting all of the native plants and the quality of plants that we needed for our projects, especially native ones. There just weren't very many available. And so that's when we started the native plant nursery, and was really motivated by a desire to minimize impacts on wildlife habitat. But it has turned out to be also a water conservation measure, because when you're using native plants that are adapted to a particular area, then you don't have to spend as much water irrigating them.
And are these plants also in places where people, in parks and recreation type places, where people are seeing them as
yes,
they exercise?
Indeed. And so one of the things that happens is we're doing more salvage of native plants along road projects and so forth. And so, for instance, there's this beautiful flower called Queen of the Night. It's the night blooming cereus. And they have a big display of them at Tohono O'Chul, right, in the summer. Some of these night-blooming cereus that we have to move because of road projects, we are putting at the library so that people can actually see them in other places in the community, not just Tohono O'Chul. People should check out the Kino Ecosystem Restoration Project. It's located near Ajo and a country club at San Leno Park. And I think it's probably the largest stormwater harvesting project in the Southwest. This was an old flood detention basin. It's 100 acres in size. Big, ugly hole in the ground. But it was built originally by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to detain some of the floodwaters that are generated from the Davis-Monthan Airport, Central Tucson area. Afterwards, after the ecosystem restoration project was really to say, can we do something better here. Can we create wetlands and riparian areas? And so a lot of the stormwater that is gathered up in this basin is circulated to reduce mosquito problems. It supports riparian vegetation and great birding area for people to see. There's a jogging trail that goes around the whole thing. And then the water that is harvested from that project is actually used to irrigate some of the ball fields at the Keno Stadium District, and along the irrigation is used for the right-of-way on the roads that are landscaped in that area.
Keno Ecosystem Restoration Project. So that's where you would recommend Pima County residents who are interested in seeing some of the work that the county is doing. That would be an ideal place to go visit.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Julia. I really appreciate you coming in. Thank you so much to Julia Fonseca for taking the time to explain the work that Pima County does to maintain our scarce surface water resources. The work the county has been doing is truly impressive. Visiting the many sites that Pima County has developed, including the Sweetwater Wetlands and the river walking paths, as well as Julia's recommendations, will give the listener a better understanding of the immense amount of work it takes to balance the needs of the environment with city infrastructure and the needs of the human community. In next week's episode, we talk with Louise Mistel of the Sky Island Alliance. Louise works for the Sky Island Alliance and advocates for science-based and climate-smart land management, conducts spatial analysis and mapping, and leads the spring survey and protection work. She focuses on improving land and resource management in the face of a changing climate and finds creative and constructive ways to collaborate with land and resource managers to better steward the resources we all care about. Louise holds a Bachelor of Science in Ecology and Evolutionary Biology and in Microbiology, and has a Master's in Science and Geographic Information Systems from the University of Arizona. Louise also spent time in Australia investigating their water issues, documented in her blog, Springs Down Under. We discuss that in next week's episode, and I am delighted to have more voices from the environmental sector on Fathoming Water. As well, in future episodes, we will be featuring highlights from the University of Arizona's Water Resource Research Center's upcoming conference on March 21st, 2016. Keep checking back for new episodes at fathomingwater.com. Fathoming Water is produced in Tucson, Arizona at KXCI Community Radio and engineered at Baby Gas Mask Records. Thank you to the University of Arizona's Water Resource Research Center for their support of Fathoming Water. Thank you to Chris Levesque for our theme music, A Walk in the Wasteland, and thank you for listening. I'm your host, Melissa Mosey.